Welcome to this week's Current Federal Tax Developments, brought to you by the Lascauzzo Institute and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to be looking at a number of developments, including Congress begins to give us the outline of what tax reform will look like, or at least a group of leaders give us the outline of what Congress will be doing. We'll also take a look at Appeal's new web-based conferencing program, some IRS steps will be taken to combat business-related identity theft that will impact how you prepare returns next year. And we'll talk about a couple of cases, one dealing again with a deemed distribution from a 401k plan. This time, the question is, when did the distribution take place? And then the second one deals with a taxpayer who ran into trouble trying to prove that he was away from home in order to be able to claim certain travel, commuting, and meals expenses. Well, I'm back this week. Been up in Montana, so I had a good time up there. Doing a couple days, heading out to Albuquerque, New Mexico in the following week. So I'm doing a bit of traveling this time. And coming up, we have some courses that I want you to look forward to going a little further down the line here. Don Cochran's got some courses in the state of Washington I want to remind you of. On the 24th, estate and gift taxation, planning and compliance. And the 25th, multi-state taxation of business. Both of these are in the Seattle area. They'll be out at the Washington Society of CPAs offices in Bellevue, Washington. In September, I will be going to the Cincinnati area in Fairfield, Ohio, and I'm going to have a pair of days there. The first day is actually 2 4-hour sessions. In the morning, we'll talk about the alternative minimum tax and how that's impacted. In the afternoon, we'll talk about the passive activity issues and surviving IRS challenges on passive activities. Those are kind of important. And on September the 28th, we're going to talk about the multi-state taxation of business, this time in the Ohio area. Now, this multi-state course is beginning interesting because the states are going further and further in attempting to find ways to create nexus, to be able to impose tax on businesses that are operating in other states but not currently paying income tax to the state or currently collecting sales tax for the state. So that's kind of an interesting and hot topic. So you want to be sure if you've not been keeping up on that, you probably wouldn't be a bad idea to show up and go to one of those courses. Again, in this case, this will be in Fairfield, Ohio, and in the Cincinnati area. If you want to sign up for that course, you can go to Ohio CPA website, the ohiocpa.com for the Ohio Society of CPAs. So let's go ahead now and let's get started with this week's news. Well, Congress has been around this week, and yeah, many of you probably have been paying attention to the attempt to pass repeal or replace. We had four separate bills four separate different approaches that the Senate rejected, not accepting anything and finally giving up. So we're off of that, maybe. Always tough to say what you'd be on and off of here. But certainly by the time they got to the skinny repeal, we had very little tax material in the health care bill. But we are talking about now moving on potentially to comprehensive tax reform. And this week, the Big Six. Now, the Big Six is interesting. It's a name that's given to a group that's been working on and developing an outline for the comprehensive tax reform to give kind of a structure for the whole program to move forward as Congress would take a look at this. It's made up of Speaker Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from the Senate from Kentucky, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, National Economic Council Director, I should say, Gary Cohn, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch from Utah, and House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady from Texas. Those six released an outline this week that you'll find on July 27th. It was posted, and you can see it on the White House Office of the Press Secretary's website. And in this particular case, this release outlines the broad aspects of what will be part of the tax reform proposal, which Congress is about to begin work on. Now, basically, the outline here is very, very broad. In fact, probably has fewer details than certainly what we had a year ago from the House GOP Better Way, which, again, was missing a lot of specific details. And less detailed than what President Trump put out during his campaign, even less than what was put out by the president and the Treasury Secretary earlier this year has reformed. So we've kind of got a very broad outline. We don't know a whole lot, but we did find out one important thing in this release. This release makes it clear that they are not planning to push for a border adjustable tax. In fact, the statement says, While we have debated the pro-growth benefit of border adjustability, we appreciate that there are many unknowns associated with it and have decided to set this policy aside in order to advance tax reform. That seems to be a way of saying effectively goodbye to the border adjustable tax. We're not going to take a look at that this time. So if you've been paying attention to that or you've read up about that and we're looking at potential impacts of that, as of right now, it looks like the BAT is off the table. So we're not going to be looking at that as part of the reform provision. So the question is, what are we going to be looking at? Well, it does tell us something. We have a paragraph that tells us some information. They tell us that basically, you know, that tax relief for American families should be at the heart of our plan. Again, nice statement, but we're not quite sure what that's going to mean. You know, it's kind of hard to be against tax relief for American families. It always sounds good. We also believe there should be a lower rate for small businesses so they can compete with larger ones, and lower rates for all American businesses so they can compete with foreign ones. That suggests that we're going to be seeing lower rates, but again, no discussion here of what that rate would be. Obviously, a lower rate could be going down 1 percentage point, or it could be dropping all the way to the 15% rate that had been discussed. Right now, we don't have any commitment for what level they're going for. They do say they want to reduce rates as much as possible. They also want to allow unprecedented capital expensing. Now, that's also been discussed, but they didn't say if that's going to be full and immediate expensing of purchases of equipment, or if it's going to be tied to the fact that you couldn't deduct interest if you claim that full expensing option. We also don't know how or if it would integrate in any way, shape, or form with Section 179. Does it replace 179, or is it in addition to 179? Again, we're going to take a look. Again, details, as always, is always going to be our problem in this area. So we have this particular issue. Right, and it places a priority on permanence. Now, that's important because, as you are probably aware, this is part of the, you know, what we had here, the reconciliation bill. This was the second reconciliation process. Under the rules of reconciliation, we cannot increase the deficits more than 10 years out. If that, you know, if we continue that, if we don't change that rule, and again, it's a congressional rule, so Congress could always change the rule, but if they don't change that rule, and it does not seem like the Senate wants to change the rule, and it's really the Senate's rule, then that may limit pretty dramatically what they can do, because they, if we're going to make it permanent, we can't increase deficits more than 10 years out. And that means that whatever we do is going to be kind of strictly restricted. Dropping border adjustable tax, which was, you know, on track to raise, they estimate, about $1 trillion, truly takes away a lot of money off the table that could have been used to, you know, do other things like reduce tax rates. So again, we're not sure how much can be done. We're not sure where they're going to find the offsets, or at least the offsets more than 10 years out, if they plan to make this program permanent. So we'll have to take a look, see how this is going to go. Obviously, the key issue here, we're going to have a lot more details. This one-page document, which actually, when you get frankly right down to it, has only two paragraphs, really, that tell you what's in the program. This, you know, it's not much to work from. It does tell us something, and as I said, the big news is probably border adjustable tax. And we mentioned last week about an attempt by a South Carolina representative to effectively get rid of it. It looks like this week it was decided we simply are going to get rid of it. That's not going to be part of the program. But keep your eyes open. Again, if Congress plans to do this, and they plan to do it here shortly before the 2018 election cycle gets revved up, when it'd be very difficult to move comprehensive reform, we may see this start moving quicker. The other question is what they're going to do about health care, and whether this becomes the thing they start doing now instead of health care, or whether they're going to try one more try at somehow coming up with something they can vote on in health care. Keep your eyes open. But again, tax reform, at least we're seeing the beginning of movement, and presumably we're going to see some action on health care, on tax reform, I should say, start taking place in the tax writing committees once Congress gets back from the August recess. Next thing coming up here, let's talk about the IRS announced this week, the appeals did, that they're going to start a web-based conferencing system pilot. This is News Release 2017-122. It was issued on July the 24th. The IRS in this news release tells us that they're going to begin offering web-based conferencing options. Currently, they offer the option to conference with an appeals officer in person, by phone, or by going to an IRS office, and there are only a few of them, that have video conferencing systems set up, where you would video conference with an appellate conferee located at some other location. We're now going to expand this to allow you to web conference if anywhere in the country, the theory would be, with an IRS appellate conferee. This could be very useful for taxpayers who are in, let's say, remote rural locations, where you might have a problem of it would be a very long ride to go into an IRS office to meet the appellate conferee. So the idea is we could hold a secure web-based appellate conference, because as they note here for part of this, you know, one of the things we find is that a lot of people don't, you know, don't really like the phone-based conference. They want to have at least some eye contact. So gives you the option. Now, one issue is that this is very brief. It is a pilot program only. It will start August 1st. And they don't tell us the exact details on the program they're going to be using. And I think many of us have probably used at least one video conferencing program. If for nothing else, many of you have used it to like get CPE. So you log into a conferencing program. You're generally kept quiet. The presenter talks during the program. But that's the type of web-based conferencing. This time, though, we turn on the other side. So if you've done things like we talk about FaceTime on Apple, Google Hangouts on Android phones, you know, you've probably done this sort of thing back and forth where you've talked with people on the other side. The idea would be that we would allow this to happen for an appellate conference. So you'd see the conferee on the screen. You and your client would be able to conference over the internet. Now, one thing this will do, if this catches on, I will tell you, if you've not already done so, and a lot of us haven't, you know, you might want to take a look at setting up your conference room to be able to, you know, handle website, handle conferencing, you know, where you, the two of you are sitting at the table and the camera picks you up and the microphone picks you up. That does take a little bit of work to set up your rooms. Because most likely you would like for you and the client to be together in the room talking to the agent. And it's probably not going to work well for both of you to try to stare down a laptop computer. Just saying that may be an issue. It may be a problem. And you might actually like to work on your own computer for part of that. So in any event, keep an eye on this. We're certainly seeing this sort of thing come up. And probably web-based conferencing is going to become a very normal way of working. In fact, your clients may start asking you for it. So you might consider, you know, how you could rig something up to let that work for a conferencing solution that could work in your conference room. Next up, the IRS in News Release 2017-123 and Fact Sheet 2017-10, issued on July 24th, gave us some information about ID theft. And the big issue at this point is we are starting to see more and more business-related ID theft. Individual ID theft, the IRS announced, was down rather dramatically. They had 47% fewer reports of tax-related ID theft this year to date than they did the same period the year before. You know, the states and the IRS have gotten more aggressive at trying to cut down on fake returns being allowed through the system. That's the main way we discover ID theft, because what happens is, you know, the fake return goes in, they paid that out, your client tries to file, and magically, of course, your return's rejected. So we've seen a pretty dramatic drop, and my experience this year was that I didn't have problems with ID theft this year, at least not so far, and this is the first year I haven't had it in a couple of years. We haven't had in the office a major problem of any sort with it. So crossing my fingers, it looks like they may actually have this under control. But there's bad news. We've had a lot higher amount of business identity theft. Now, it's still much lower than individual. You know, we had basically 97,000, we had basically this year, 200, and, you know, basically, let's see, get the numbers here from the IRS. So in the first 5 months of 2015, they had 297,000 identity theft victims. That's, you know, that's significant. So that's what it was last year. We've had the drop this year. Now, flipping it though, business-related ID thefts grew from 4,000 the prior year to 10,000 in the same period. This is where they take over the business IDs, the ID numbers, start filing fake 941s, create fake W-2s, file fake claims for refunds, change your business address to get things coming back. There are various structures they do to try to take control of your system. And the affected returns are not just business returns. You know, it's not just the 1120, the 1120S, the 1065s. They've also seen some trust returns, 1041, trust and estate income tax returns, where the identities have been taken over and used. So what the IRS announced this year is that we're going to start seeing requests in our tax software for additional information to be provided. For instance, they're going to want to have the name and social security number of the company executive authorized to sign the return. And they're going to ask, is this person authorized? So the idea there, I'm sure, first is to cross match. So now I don't just need the name of the company, but I need to have a name and ID number of a, you know, of an officer of the company. We'll have to see how well they can cross match that. We need to know the payment history, where estimated tax payments made. And if yes, you know, when they were made, how were they made and how much was paid? So it's not just enough to, you know, kind of sit there and hope or send something in and, you know, hope to get a refund back by hoping that the company has paid some of this. We're going to try to do it a little differently in this regard. Okay. We're going to do it just slightly differently. We're going to ask you some questions. We'll ask for parent company information. Is there a parent company? If yes, who? Specific deductions will require additional information once where they expect there's been a lot of fraud issues going on. And they'll ask you, has the business filed other tax returns? Like, you know, 940s, 941s. Did you file 940? Did you file 941? Did you file any other thing like an excise tax return? What exactly has been filed? And we're going to ask this apparently as part of just filing the 1120S. Now, the IRS also in the fact sheet gave us some information the client should look at that may be indicative of the fact they've had ID theft. The first one's obvious. Extension to file requests rejected because a return with that employer ID number or social security number is already on file, or an e-file return is rejected for the same reason. Well, that way we usually run into. But here's one that we've seen, and we saw this some in individuals, an unexpected receipt of a tax transcript or an IRS notice that doesn't correspond to anything you've ever submitted, or a failure to receive expected and routine correspondence. That could indicate that the thief has changed the address of the company after taking over the ID. That can be done to try to make sure that, of course, you don't know about what's been going on since the letters from the IRS just start going to nowhere. So be careful. The big thing is to be ready. We're going to have to be ready to get that additional information we're going to need in the upcoming tax season. So just keep your eye out for that stuff and be aware. More information is going to be needed on business returns next year. Next up, the case of Goen versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2017-57. This case came down on July the 24th of 2017. Now, this is yet another plan loan case. We talked about one last week. Now we're going to talk about this one this week. This case, the taxpayer took out a loan from a 401k. And a few months later, he was laid off. So the actual test was on March 12th, he borrowed $50,000 from the retirement plan, the plan that was administered by Merrill Lynch. The loan required him to make 120 semi-monthly payments of $451.72. And of course, normally they would make the payments, you know, the payments being made usually come out of your payroll check. Obviously, you lose your job, then you've got to keep making those payments on your own. And if you don't, then you're no longer in compliance with the loan. Now, he, of course, as soon as he lost his job because he was let go, they missed a payment on August 30th of 2012. And Merrill Lynch sent him a notice dated October 23rd stating that your loan payment is past due. Your loan's in danger of being defaulted. Under the terms of the plan, he had up until the end of the calendar quarter following the quarter in which default took place in order to correct the problem. So since he defaulted in the third quarter of 2012, he had till the end of the fourth quarter of 2012, or at least the way Merrill Lynch interpreted this, to December 31st, 2012, to correct the problem. He did not correct the problem. The plan administrator, therefore, in January of 2013, sent him a letter stating that, you know, the loan has been defaulted. They sent this letter on January 7th, and that it was going to report a deemed distribution of $46,703. It also sent a 1099-R. Now, he claims he never received it, but that also reported the $49,000 amount that was paid out. Now, he claimed, wait. When he filed his return for 2012, he didn't include the deemed distribution. He claimed he did so first because he didn't receive the 1099-R. Well, you know, that's not going to help you. But secondly, he said the statement sent by Merrill Lynch was dated January 7th that said there was a distribution. Therefore, the distribution took place in 2013. The tax court said, well, we don't really think that's the way it works. The taxpayer conceded that the balance was outstanding, you know, in 2012 and that he defaulted in August. Now, you know, he said that, you know, all I was told, and I got three notices, October 23rd, November 26th, December 26th, that said my loan was in danger of default, and that he wasn't notified of actual default till January 7th. So he says, well, that really shouldn't count. Secondly, he said, the regulation, he claims, under these rules doesn't do a maximum cure period, and he was told by Merrill Lynch the cure period was 6 months. So he said, well, I couldn't have failed the cure until 2013. The court said, nope, that's not right. The maximum cure period is essentially the last day of the calendar quarter after the calendar quarter of the first calendar quarter after the quarter in which the default took place. That's what the regulation allows as a maximum. And that cure date ended on December 31st. The court also said the January 7th notice made no mention of when the default took place. It was just a letter that was, you know, printed on January 7th and that informed him there had been a, you know, informed him that there was a distribution. And it said, you know, sorry guys, basically this is taxable in 2012. They also said, if you look at the example in Regulation 1.72-1, Question and Answer 10C, they have an example which coincidentally has a default in August of a year and has his cure date at December 31st and as the distribution date as in the year of the default, the 2002 year, which was the example. So the court concluded, sorry, guy, you were taxable on this in 2012, which was the year in which you defaulted. You defaulted in August of 2012. You did not correct by December 31st of 2012. You are deemed to have received a distribution of the entire amount of the plan loan on December 31st of 2012, and as such, you have to report it on your 2012 return. Next case, we're going to take a look at the case here of Wooten versus Commissioner Tax Court Summary Opinion 2017-58. This again was issued on July the 24th. Now, this is a taxpayer who was a plumber pipe fitter for a contractor in Mississippi. He had to work at various locations, some in Gulfport or Biloxi, which was 20-25 miles from his home, and two in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, which was about 56 miles from his home. Now, he kept log of his travel to and from his home to these locations. And in fact, he had claimed this commuting on prior year's returns. And of course, he said, I've never been questioned about this. He also took a deduction for meals that he consumed at the location, you know, for lunch, because obviously, I mean, it's 56 miles back to home. So obviously he had to eat lunch on the road. So shouldn't he get the deduction because it was so far away for these jobs he was assigned to work? Shouldn't he be able to take the commuting deduction? And shouldn't he be able to claim a deduction for the meals? Well, the problem with commuting, as the court notes, is that basically commuting expenses are generally not deductible. The only exception, one exception to the rule is if you commute to a temporary work location. But one of the key rules here with the temporary work location is, and it's mentioned in the court citing the Bogue case from 2011, you have to show that you have a work location outside the metropolitan area in which the taxpayer normally lives and works. And the metropolitan area, as I said, is kind of ill-defined. Revenue ruling 99-7 talks about metro area. But he conceded that he normally worked in the area of Gulfport and Biloxi. Because of that, the court found, well, that's your tax home. That's where you normally work. So that any into that area obviously cannot qualify as commuting expenses. And as well, we should say, they also said he didn't show us that Hattiesburg was really at 56 miles outside that general metro area. So the court denied the deduction for all of his claimed auto expenses, saying that none of it was deductible because it all represented non-deductible commuting. What about the meals? Well, meals are a little different test. You get meals if you can meet three criteria. You had to be away from your tax home at the time the expense was incurred, the expense was reasonable and necessary, and the expense was concurred in the pursuit of a trade or business. Now, the key issue is, how do you show you're away from your tax home? To be away from home under this rule, you have to show that you're on a trip that will require the taxpayer to stop and take time to sleep or rest for a substantial period. For instance, this week I was in, you know, I was up in Bozeman, Montana. Bozeman is a little distance from Phoenix. You know, I realize we're both in the western U.S., but they're really not close to each other. So my business-related trip to Bozeman, Montana required me to basically have time away and, yes, get a hotel room and, you know, sleep. Yeah, I actually did sleep while I was in Bozeman. So because I did some, you know, I basically had to get a room, sleep, have rest period, that means that the meals on that trip are allowed as a deduction. In this case, Mr. Wooten could not show that he actually, that was true. First thing is, obviously, Gulfport Biloxi is going to fail that test because that became his tax home. But what about Hattiesburg? Maybe that was far enough away. Well, because this doesn't look at metro areas, it just looks at far enough away. He didn't show that that actually was true in those cases. Obviously, the key question is going to be, did you really have substantial rest periods whenever you were sent to Hattiesburg to work on a job? He had no evidence in that regard, and probably the answer was no. 56 miles, while it's a decent distance, it's also not so far that you're likely not to come home at night. So most likely, he came home when he was 56 miles away. So most likely, no deduction. The thing to remember here is, if your client's trying to claim a deduction for any auto-related expenses going to work sites or any expenses related to meals for, quote, travel away from home, you got to remember to take a look at the detailed rules and the regulation. The default answer for both of those is generally going to be no. You've got to clear the hurdles to allow your client to take that deduction. Well, remember again, we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for your state CPA society offering these courses that allow us to spend time doing all this work, allow me to spend time actually looking in, writing up these things, writing up the course materials, and doing this podcast. So be sure to take a look at what your state society is offering and take the time to, you know, decide, go down. You know, there's a few things better than having an 8-hour session where you can actually ask somebody, and not just the instructor. Let's be honest, you can gain a lot from talking to other people in the room when you deal with this, when you have the pure live sessions. So take a look at what your society is offering and, you know, consider going down and taking a course. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments here for the week of July 31st. Be sure to catch our daily updates on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I remind you, we do have the articles for this week. They're in a PDF. You can find them on that website. Go to the weekly updates, and you'll find, as part of this update, under at the bottom of this, I will have a link to the actual, you know, PDF document that will give you all the write-ups on these cases. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. And also, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at edzollers. That's where you'll find me there. Well, hopefully you have a nice, good week here in summer. We're at the end of July, beginning of August, so we're getting to that, you know, kind of dog days of summer where things seem to quiet down. Hopefully it quiets down for you. And be sure to join us back here next week. We'll try to tell you what's been going on in the area of federal taxes.